KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Downtown.
Fruitvale, out in East Oakland.
I live in Lake Merritt neighborhood.
Coming up, we hear from protesters and counter-protesters at the Walk for Life in San Francisco over the weekend.
The one thing that annoys me the most about life in modern society is that abortion rights are considered progressive and leftist, because I think there is nothing more progressive than to defend those humans who are the weakest and the tiniest and who have absolutely no voice.
Then why car sharing has gotten easier in Berkeley and Oakland.
Families tell us that they were able to sell their second car.
Plus the story behind the construction of a Bay Area bridge.
If you're building a bridge, wouldn't you want it to be shorter?
That's all coming up next on Cross Currents. 2 weeks ago, President Trump addressed a crowd at the National Walk for Life in D.C. via teleconference. He's the first sitting president to ever speak at the event. This Saturday, the 14th annual Walk for Life West Coast took place in San Francisco. Thousands of people marched down Market Street carrying signs saying, "Unborn lives matter and adoption is an option." The walk was met by several hundred counter-protesters out to defend abortion rights. We sent KALW's Amber Miles to Civic Center to speak with people on both sides of the issue.
I'm Barbara Moody. I'm principal at St. Anthony Immaculate Conception School. This is a good event. It's not just for Catholics. It's for all people who believe in life, that life is precious. It's a gift from God, and that every single person that is born has a gift to bring to the world. I don't think that there's a momentum to change the laws per se. I think it's our job here to witness to conception through death, and that through that, and we can only change our policies in government to be pro-life, to respect people's need for health care, to support families in need. If we had a government that did that, then maybe we would see less people choosing to abort their fetus. We have to just have better policies so people don't see abortion as an option, but they see I have options here.
My name's Fred. I'm a longtime San Franciscan, and I'm out here every one of these Walk for Life marches. And it's one thing for people to be against abortion. A lot of us believe everybody should be making our own decision, that this is a healthcare issue, healthcare rights, and that the clinics need to be safe, accessible, affordable, and that they do a whole range of women's health care. This city here in Northern California continues to provide abortion and before it, but the city power structure was not enough against this, against these religious zealots coming out here every year. They have this big rally. Some of us want to make sure they don't do it unopposed, because they're trying to recruit people. They're sending horrible messages. Abortion's genocide, murder, as if it's fact.
Again, we pray that the Lord our God will preserve this city and this holy habitation and every city and country from abortion, euthanasia, pestilence, famine.
My name is Matthew Yoakum. I'm from Riverside, California, and I help organize a Walk for Life event every year for our church. And so we bring Orthodox Christians from Southern California to come protest in San Francisco with the Walk for Life. I personally disagree a lot with what Trump has done. And I think he undermines women and how they're precious to us. So the chief Christian in Orthodox Christianity is a woman. And so when he says things like, "I'm going to grab them by their private parts," we think that undermines the position of women in our life, right? I hope that he genuinely has a pro-life position, and it seems like maybe he does, but I think that in overall, he hurts women, and that's definitely not what we're about, but you take the good when you can get it, right? So that's kind of where I'm at personally. The unbelieving to true faith and
piety, and the believing. My name is Joanna. I'm 31. I just finished my PhD in journalism studies, and I'm looking for work right now, and I live at Stanford. My husband is a student there. I just was always pro-life, but I became especially pro-life after having a kid myself, because I just realized in my own body what it's like to have a little human growing in there and kicking and, you know, seeing on the ultrasound. And I just couldn't understand, especially because I'm a rather left-wing person. I support universal healthcare and, you know, help for mothers and all kinds of progressive causes. And I just, it's like the one thing that annoys me the most about life in modern society is that abortion rights are considered progressive and leftist, because I think there is nothing more progressive than to defend those humans who are the weakest and the tiniest and who have absolutely no voice. I consider myself a feminist, and there are other groups here, you know, who have that message as well. And I just don't think that, you know, convenience justifies killing another human being. Of course, there are cases where it's one life against another, and those are extremely difficult decisions. So I think women should be supported, you know, when they have crisis pregnancies. I don't believe personally in outlawing abortion at this point, because it will always be available. Even these companies that, you know, just send pills to people, you know, it's always going to happen. So I prefer it to be legal and to be safe, but I'm not pro-choice because I want it to be unthinkable.
My name is Toni Mendocino. I'm active with Bay Area Freedom Socialist Party. I'm also a member of Teamsters 2010, my union. And I'm here today to stand up for the need for reproductive rights and justice for all women, especially for poor women, who are the ones that are hardest hit when abortion is illegal or health services are not available. And I feel that this is one of the most urgent things, is that we don't go backward in time. And the fact that people are in the street today rallying against abortion on near the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, to me, impelled me to come out and say, I think we need more safe, legal abortion and free health care and free child care.
My name is Eric Tinoco. I come from Fremont, the city of Fremont here in California. I am an immigrant. I am under DACA. So when I hear about pro-life, it's not just the babies. The babies are really important, are the most important part of life, right? Because that's where everything begins. But when you don't respect life after that, you're not really pro-life. That's how I feel. If you see my sign, I have impeached Trump. That's because I feel the president is using the movement to gain more followers instead of really being pro-life. If you are pro-life, you have to respect life from the beginning to the end, from the baby till the person that is about to die. Every part of life has to be respected. The immigrants, the refugees, minorities, women, everyone has to be respected. That's what real pro-life is.
Those were the voices of Barbara Moody, Fred LaFave, Matthew Yoakum, Joanna Nurmi, Toni Mendocino, and Eric Tinoco. The piece was reported by Amber Miles. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Zipcar, Ford Go Bikes, Scoot, shared vehicles are multiplying like rabbits in the Bay Area. Just this month, a company called Jump rolled its electric bikes onto San Francisco's streets. And across the Bay, Gig Car Share is doubling its fleet of black Priuses. Gig started last spring in Berkeley and Oakland, and KLW's transportation reporter Eli Wertschafter says they're looking to expand to nearby cities, including San Francisco. Eli is here in the studio with me now. Hey, Eli.
Hey, Hannah.
So car sharing has been around for a while now, but it's still not familiar to everyone. Remind us how it works.
Yeah, so car sharing is basically short-term car rental. So you can rent a car for a couple hours or even a couple minutes, whatever you need to get to the grocery store or wherever you're going. Car sharing can be great for people who don't have a car, like me. I mostly bike and take BART, but there are those times when, you know, you just need a car.
Right. So what are the different options for car sharing in the Bay Area right now?
Well, the biggest ones are Zipcar and Getaround. Zipcar is owned by Avis, the rental company, and you've probably seen Zipcar spots around BART stations scattered around town.
Right.
And to use it, you find a car near you, you reserve it online or with your phone, you drive it around, and then you bring it back to the place where you found it.
Okay.
Getaround is a little different than Zipcar because the cars belong to individuals. So think of it kind of like Airbnb, but for cars. You're renting someone else's car while they're not using it, and then you take it back to their house.
Okay.
So you had Zipcar and Getaround, and then last spring, a new player entered the market, and this one's called Gig Car Share. Mm-hmm. It's actually owned by AAA, and this is their first car share operation in the U.S., and they launched it in Oakland and Berkeley. It's the first car share service in the Bay Area that you can use for one-way trips.
Okay, one-way trips. So that's different from what was available before?
Yeah, so before there were really only round-trip services. You need to bring the car back to where you found it.
Mm-hmm.
And full disclosure, I've been using Gig Car Share myself for several months now. So I open up this app on my phone, and the first thing it shows me is a map showing places where there are gig cars nearby. So the way it works, you find a car on your phone, you unlock the car with your phone once you get to the car, and then you could drive it to any parking spot within the program's coverage area.
Okay.
And right now that includes most of Berkeley and Oakland, actually excludes some of the hills, and it excludes most of East Oakland.
Mm.
But wherever you take it within that area, you can leave it in a public parking spot.
You just leave it.
Right, you don't need to return it to where you found it. And that's it, I just walk away.
So what does that cost?
It's $2.50 a mile with a maximum charge of $15 per hour. So it's not as cheap as public transit, but the prices are competitive with Lyft and Uber.
Right, which people use a lot.
Yep.
Okay, so you said you can park in any parking space. Mm-hmm. What about spaces with meters?
Yeah, so Gig has a deal with the cities of Berkeley and Oakland so that you can park one of their cars in a metered spot and you don't have to pay. And that's crucial because you want to be able to park in downtown areas. And in general, with these systems, the more places you can leave the car, the more useful the service is.
Mm-hmm.
So Gig Car Share right now is limited to a more densely populated area of Berkeley and Oakland, but that area has gradually expanded since the program started last spring.
Mm-hmm.
And they could grow to include other cities. The president of Gig Car Share, his name is Jason Haidt, said officials in neighboring cities, including San Francisco, are encouraging them to come there, too.
The staff of SFMTA has been supportive of the one-way car share concept, and in fact, they're presenting to committee next month.
He also told me that this month and over the next couple weeks, Gig is doubling the size of their fleet. They had 250 cars out on the street. Now they're going to have 500. That's a little KLW exclusive. We're the first to report that.
All right. Sounds like a lot of cars on the street that virtually anybody can drive. What if they, you know, somebody leaves them in a place they're not supposed to, like in a red zone, in front of a fire hydrant?
Right. Well, I mean, Gig has driver's license and credit cards for all their users, and they also have every car tracked by GPS. So
they will track you down.
They will track you down. If the company needs to hold someone accountable for parking illegally or, I mean, stealing a car, they have ways to do that.
Mm-hmm.
They also have a team of employees that are running out and servicing the cars. They're filling the tanks. They could also move the cars if they're parked illegally or in the way of street sweeping. But I think what you're talking about, cars getting left in undesirable places, that's definitely a risk with this kind of stationless car sharing.
Yeah.
And you can get similar problems with stationless bike sharing, which has also surged in recent years, especially in China. It's huge in China. And you see news reports and photos from China of people just abandoning their shared bikes in the middle of the sidewalk. So I think cities have an important role in deciding how to regulate vehicle sharing.
Okay, so what is in it for the cities? Why would cities want to work with a car share program?
Okay, so the cities do get some money from GIG. The GIG is paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to the cities of Oakland and Berkeley, mostly for these parking permits. So someone is paying for that meter. But besides that, you know, car sharing in general is shown to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And some users are also able to sell their cars or postpone buying a car. So that's fewer cars taking up parking.
Okay.
Studies at UC Berkeley found that every shared car can take between 7 to 13 private cars off the road.
So you said GIG car share is owned by AAA. Why is AAA getting into the car share business?
Really, AAA is one of a bunch of players getting into the game of vehicle sharing that didn't used to be in the business of providing transportation, of providing rides to places. So think of Ford sponsoring Go Bikes or GM, which runs a car share program too. And there's an agreement among these companies and among experts who study transportation that vehicle sharing will become more and more popular. And there's this vision that a lot of them have that in the future, we're going to rely on shared fleets of electric driverless cars. So all these companies kind of want a place for themselves in that future. The official line from AAA is that they want to serve the next generation of drivers. Of course, AAA is also an insurance provider. So
yes,
it may be a strategy to get into the insurance market of the future as well.
All right, Eli, thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.
Eli Wirtschafter is our transportation reporter. You can reach out to him at transportation@klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Every day, tens of thousands of people cross the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge, which connects Contra Costa to Marin County. The bridge is known for its odd roller coaster shape. And fun fact, it's 5.5 miles long, making it the second longest bridge in the Bay after, yes, the San Mateo Bridge. But did the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge really need to be that long? Steve Shea wants to know. He's an Albany resident who crosses it every day to get to work. He reached out to our crowdsourced reporting project, Hey Area, to ask us this.
Why is the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge built on a 4-mile gap in the bay when it could have been built over a 1-mile gap in the bay just a couple miles to the north?
We sent KALW's Lisa Cantrell to find out.
It's 7:45 in the morning, and I'm in the car with commuter Steve Shea.
The traffic was so much lighter today.
We're riding in his silver hatchback.
We are going to get on the freeway right here.
And we're headed from the East Bay to his office in Novato.
Yeah, I've been commuting this job for 10 years now.
As we approach the bridge this sunny morning, the bay looks shockingly blue on either side. Steve points to the shoreline peeking over the railing just to our right.
That is actually that little peninsula that juts out that you're saying that would be one of the closest places.
Yeah, that would be a shorter way to go across, definitely.
Yeah.
He's pointing to McNear's Beach. That's the point where Steve actually thinks this bridge should have been built.
If you're building a bridge, wouldn't you want it to be shorter?
So basically, if you look at a map of the bay, just north of where the actual Richmond-San Rafael Bridge is, you'll see these two peninsulas reaching out towards one another like fingers just about to touch. On the west side, it's McNear's Beach, and on the east side, it's San Pablo Point. In terms of places to build a bridge, it would seem almost ideal. The distance really is only about a mile between these two land masses. And yet, in the 1950s, the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge was built at a much wider part of the bay, resulting in a bridge that is almost 4 times as long as it could have been.
Hi. Hey, how are you?
To find out why, I paid a visit to transportation historian Louise Dybel. And as I walk into her house, I notice something on the wall.
Is that like a picture of a bridge right there?
Yeah, that's the Brooklyn Bridge.
She's really into bridges.
To be honest with you, I love the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. I think it's really
interesting, elegant design. It's been compared to a bent coat hanger, but I like it.
I tell her about Steve and his commute and how he's a little baffled about the location. Dival pulls out this huge book and she flops it onto the dining room table.
Yeah, there's a lot of color math.
This book is actually a big report from 1951.
200 pages, approximately, and it's got lots of maps and tables and foldouts. This report was the culmination of about 10 years of study by the Division of Highways, or actually by the Bay Area Toll Authority.
Within these pages are investigations, numbers, calculations, laying out the feasibility of various bridge proposals between the East Bay and Marin County. At the front of the book is a map of the bay with lines drawn across it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 different viable locations.
Each line was a proposed route for the bridge, and the map actually shows 5 routes that cross the northernmost part of the bay, right between those 2 jutting peninsulas, where Steve said he wanted the bridge to be. As I'm looking at this map, I find myself totally relating to Steve on this. These shorter routes, I mean, they seem like they would have been an obvious choice in comparison to where the bridge was eventually constructed. So why wasn't the bridge built there?
Well, that's kind of tricky, because there was real political, environmental, and engineering challenges getting the traffic to the bridges that you would have built to the north.
A lot of this had to do with the Bay Area's oil industry.
If you look up to the north, you'll see these big tanks up on the hill, and those are storing oil and oil products.
On the East Side Peninsula, there were, and there are still to this day, oil refineries.
Any construction could potentially have posed a real hazard to those industrial facilities. And add to that, there was naval oil storage facilities.
Dival explains that building in that area where there were naval facilities meant having to get federal permission, a total headache.
So that added to another problem. So there's a lot going on. Plus, that peninsula is rocky, and the route they would have had to run the road along included areas with 5% grade. So hilly, difficult terrain. It just didn't make sense.
So whereas the length of the bridge seems so short, so perfect between McNear's Beach and San Pablo Point, realistically, it would have been a total nightmare to build there. Now, consider the route just south, the route where the bridge actually is built. This area didn't have the push factors of steep, rocky topography, no oil refineries, no naval bases, and it had a huge pull factor.
Revenue.
It boils down to money. And for a bridge to make money, it has to have a lot of traffic going over it. Dival explains that one way to get traffic going over a bridge is to build it in a location where there's already people and roads leading into those routes.
Probably the number one factor was the fact that there was already a ferry in that very location. 101, already in place, 101 pretty much looked like it does now, back in 1956.
It was the path that connected the most people and roads on one side to the most people and roads on the other side, ensuring the highest flow of traffic and thus, being a toll bridge, the highest amount of revenue.
I don't think this was a controversial decision at all. I mean, it made common sense to the people who knew Marin County and knew Contra Costa County, you know, to build a bridge where the traffic already was.
Okay, do you have 5 minutes for
the
groceries and stuff? All right.
I bring this information back to Steve.
I went and talked to a woman named Louise Dival.
Okay.
And she is a historian.
I show him a copy of the map from Dival's big report.
Okay, so I want you to hold on to this. So these were all the proposals, right? Yeah, you can keep it. That'd be awesome. So this is obviously actually where the bridge is.
Yeah.
These were all proposals up here. So this right here where you're talking about.
I give him the whole rundown, the rough terrain, the oil refineries, the ferries, and importantly, revenue.
That is really interesting.
So does that answer your question?
That totally answers the question.
Cool. All right.
Yeah, this is great.
Another Hay Area question answered, another curious mind satiated. So now we can turn our attention to other oddities of the bay.
Yeah. San Francisco is very pointy at this end.
At the Richmond San Rafael Bridge, this is Lisa Cantrell for Cross Currents.
That story was part of Hay Area, where you ask the questions and we find the answers. If you've got something you'd like a KALW reporter to investigate, go to klw.org and look for the box that says Hay Area. Today's Cross Currents team includes Atemu Atan, Angela Johnston, Nina Gensler-Debs, Amber Miles, Lisa Morehouse, Marissa Ortega-Welch, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are James Rollins, Gabe Graben, and Jackie Sajiko. The line producer is Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Local folk, country, and blues musicians Quattlebaum and Laura Lewis will perform at the Lost Church in San Francisco tomorrow. Show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.